The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from the Clark County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Wright Memorial Library, and Dayton Metro Library.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and it's my pleasure to welcome to the program and the studio Dave Nolan. Hello, Dave.
Hello.
Dave, I understand that you spent many years working in our area doing something that sounds really fun and important. Tell us about your previous occupation.
Well, I spent my entire career with the Five Rivers Metro Parks. Before that, it was called the Park District of Dayton-Montgomery County. But it's a great agency that's a park district in Ohio, which is kind of a unique type of regional park system. And Dayton has a really good one, or the region has a really good one. And I was fortunate enough to work there my entire career. The whole time I was really in charge of the conservation aspects of the agency. That also does, you know, of course, education and recreation. But it owns and manages some 16,000 acres of land, and that all needs some TLC. So I got to help do that.
Dave, I heard a rumor that when you came on board, it wasn't 16,000 and that you had something to do with that increase.
Yeah, that's true. After a while, I sort of became the realtor for the agency, and I think I added something like 7,000 acres to it over my career, although I'd had no training going into it. I just sort of picked it up and started doing it.
Well, this is the Book Nook, and David has a book, and it's a beautiful new book, and I'm sure listeners out there are going to want to know more about it. So let's talk to them about this book. It's called Discovery and Renewal on Huffman Prairie, Where Aviation Took Wing. And in this book, you describe something that happened. What was it, 1984, that you went out there, and I think your dad was driving. Give us the story. I love this story.
Oh, yes. I got interested in the prairies of this area. I found some old maps and records that said where they used to be and started going around to see if there was anything left. And to my surprise, I found the bits and scraps here and there that somehow had not been destroyed. Most of them were. But the map showed that the biggest one was out on Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, which the average civilian couldn't just go out there and look around. You had to get past the security gate and have a pass and all that. Now, I didn't have such a thing. My father did, because he worked on the base for most of his career. And so I convinced him to take me out there and look around for what he thought was tall weeds, and but he went along with it, you know, good dad, I guess, and took me out there, and we got way back there by the Wright brothers' old flying field, and there was this huge field of prairie grass there. I mean, which is unheard of in Ohio, especially on flat, rich farmland. There it was, and it was sort of an accident. The base just mowed it every year, and they were in the process of mowing it even as we were there.
And you just freaked out at that point, didn't you? Didn't you go, they're mowing it. We got to stop them.
Well, yeah. Yeah. So we got out, and when the mower came by and talked to the guy in the mower, and he was pretty friendly, you know. But he just got on the radio and called his boss, who then came out, and we explained to him, or I did, it was a prairie, and maybe we should refrain from mowing it for a while. And one thing led to another, and the base really got a hold of that concept and eventually dedicated it as a state natural landmark with the Ohio Department of Natural Resources.
And that apparently was the day when your love affair with Huffman Prairie began.
Yes, it is.
And this book is a product of his passion for this beautiful area, Discovery and Renewal on Huffman Prairie, Where Aviation Took Wing. And you take your readers all the way back. I had no idea of the, would we call it geological history of this region. You give a very good in-depth explanation of the forces that have taken place here over millions of years. Tell us about it.
Yes, the history of the prairie is sort of geological as well as ecological and human aspects of it as well. The prairie sits in the middle of a big river valley that is we call our aquifer now, but the Mad River flows over the valley of what once was a much larger river called the Hamilton River, and the glaciers plugged that thing up and filled it all in with sand and gravel, and that's why we have these wonderful aquifers around here. But it's also where most of these prairies were, was in these kind of gravelly glacial deposits along the rivers, and also wetlands like we have in the Beaver Creek wetlands, for instance. So there was a whole mosaic of these interesting non-forested habitats that covered a lot of our region. Unfortunately, they're mostly gone now, but we do have some really nice representatives of what they were like.
My guest is David Nolan, and Dave lives in Washington Township. As he mentioned earlier, he had a long career here in the area with Five Rivers Metro Park and a particular passion for the restoration of Huffman Prairie. His book is Discovery and Renewal on Huffman Prairie, Where Aviation Took Wing. It's recently been published by the Kent State University Press, and they did a beautiful job on this. It's filled with photos and maps, color photos, and it's one of these rare books where, as I was reading through it, I didn't find a single typo. Now, you probably found one, but I didn't find one, and I was so impressed by that.
Glad to hear you didn't find them.
Are there a few?
Mostly the scientific names. There's a few.
Okay. See, I wouldn't catch those.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, it's beautifully done, and we learn about the plant life, and we learn about why certain plants grew where they grew and what kind of water was in there. Talk about that a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Well, when the glaciers were here and they were melting, there's obviously a lot of water around here, a tremendous amount of water, both from the melting glacier and then even after it was gone, all the water that would flow through these deposits of gravel and make springs everywhere. And that's where we got, you know, Springfield or Spring Valley. You know, that was because we have so much spring water coming out of these glacial deposits. And also where that happened, where the springs came out, was vegetation that is really goes back virtually all the way to the glacier that's survived in these where these spring water comes out. They're relict sort of ancient plant communities that have hung on because of the unique conditions where the springs are. The prairies actually came somewhat later, more like 6,000 to 8,000 years ago. There was some climate change. The scientists call it the hypsothermal interval. But basically it got hot and dry for a couple thousand years, and so hot and dry that the prairies sort of invaded most of western Ohio. So Ohio back in those days looked like Illinois did. I mean, it was all prairie land.
Huh.
And by the time the pioneers got here, the climate had changed back to the way it was, and most of the trees had returned. The forest covered most of the land. But there were big patches that it hadn't covered up yet.
When I picture the great herds of American bison, I always picture them out west, out in Nebraska, out in Wyoming. I never picture them here in Ohio. When I learned, I learned that they were out here too, weren't they?
They were. There's good records of them in the Mad River Valley, both bison, elk, you know, timber wolves, turkey, you know, tremendous game. And that was one reason the prairies were still here when the pioneers got here, is because the Native Americans knew that these were their wild pastures. This is where the buffalo wanted to be and the elk. And the Indians set them on fire on purpose to keep them open, to discourage trees. And I think that's significant. You know, we oftentimes don't think of Native Americans as affecting the landscape, but they did.
And that was because, for one thing, it was easier to hunt when you could see the prey, when you could see the game. And they also used it as a hunting technique, didn't they? Didn't they? They herd with fire.
They did.
Yeah.
They did. There's good records of that. And they certainly did that. They also wanted like a brush-free forest if possible. That way you could stalk game more stealthily without cracking of sticks and brush and things like that. And this all comes from records of people that were participating in these events with the Native Americans.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes they were captives that could write, you know, English and give accounts of what happened.
Yeah, you have one great account there from a fellow who was actually was he kidnapped by the tribe? He was living with the tribe, and he gives his account of them hunting with fire.
Yes.
Yeah. Uh-huh. It's fascinating. The book is Discovery and Renewal on Huffman Prairie, Where Aviation Took Wing. David Nolan wrote it, and he joins us on the Book Nook today. And we're going to take a break here, but when we come back, we're going to talk about a guy named Ludlow. Stay tuned. The Book Nook continues on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I've been joined in studio today by David Nolan. His book is Discovery and Renewal on Huffman Prairie, Where Aviation Took Wing. I know there's a place in Ohio called Ludlow Falls. Is this the same Ludlow that is such a powerful presence in your book?
Same Ludlow.
Tell us about this guy.
Same Ludlow as Ludlow Street in Dayton. Israel Ludlow was a federal surveyor that was engaged to lay out the boundaries of what we call the land between the Miamis or the Miami Purchase. And back, I think it was 1785, the Continental Congress passed a law that the land that is acquired by the United States from the wilderness would be laid out in a systematic fashion with townships of 36 square miles. And to do that, they had to have surveyors come out and mark those section lines in the wilderness. So they had to, with great precision, mark where the corners and the lines for all these sections were. And they did this with a seven-person team and a long chain. And they would measure this chain out 80 times to get a mile. And all along the way, they would keep records of what they were witnessing. And so what that meant is that people that wanted to buy a piece of land would know exactly where it was they were acquiring their land and what it was like, and maybe whether or not they wanted to buy it in the first place. So it was really some of the best, you know, examples of modern surveying of the time. And the thing is, though, that these surveyors, because the only reference point they had was the vegetation and the landscape, they had to be somewhat naturalists. So they had to be able to know their trees, for instance, and what the vegetation was like. And so they didn't mean to, but they ended up making a really nice record of the pre-settlement vegetation of Ohio, really.
And Ludlow and his chain gang came right through Huffman Prairie.
They did. They crossed it three different places, I think, and made good records of it.
So you knew exactly what kind of plants were growing there before everything changed.
We knew the terrain, that it was a prairie or some of it was a very wet prairie. They didn't go into do a botanical inventory, but they certainly were pretty consistent about how they identified plant communities.
Can you imagine what that must have been like? Of course, it was grueling hard work covering all that land, but to be out there, and didn't they have a guy they called the spy?
Mm-hmm.
What was his job?
The spy would trail behind to make sure that no one was following them. And they also had a couple guys out front that was making sure they weren't going to run into trouble. So especially for a while, pretty dangerous business. But it's still, to me, mind-boggling how you can go up and down hills through uncharted forests and wetlands and make lines that are perfectly straight. And those lines are still used today. Uh-huh. Those are the same lines you see on a modern topographical map.
Wow.
And the ones that Ludlow and his team laid out.
And Ludlow was having some difficulties with cooperation from some of the military authorities. You have a letter in there that he sent to, was it Alexander Hamilton, the head of the Treasury?
Yes.
I love that letter. He's complaining.
Yeah. Well, he was frustrated because he was given this assignment to do the survey, but he couldn't get any help because so many people were afraid of attacks from Native Americans, and nobody could so they just couldn't spare the guards and the resources it would take to protect the survey teams. So his progress was much slowed by that until especially after the Battle of Fallen Timbers and the Treaty of Greenville, then things got a lot easier for the federal surveyors.
Hmm. And he had a short life. He died young. Yet How much ground do you figure he covered on these surveys?
You know, I couldn't say, but most of the land between the Miamis, and he did plenty of other things too. For instance, he laid out the city of Cincinnati.
Amazing.
And the city of Hamilton. So, I mean, I think he was 39 when he passed away.
Wow. Ludlow. Remember the name. The book is Discovery and Renewal on Huffman Prairie, Where Aviation Took Wing. And some of our listeners are saying, would they start taking wing just about now and start talking about why we actually think of Huffman Prairie? Because if it weren't for these two brothers, would we even have this?
No.
Tell us about these guys.
These two guys from Dayton, Ohio, gifted amateur engineers, I guess you might say, were passionate about discovering the secrets of powered flight. And much has been written about them. I won't pretend to be an expert on the Wright brothers. Safe to say they went to North Carolina with their invention and in 1903 achieved the first powered flight carrying a human being aloft for 59 seconds on the dunes at Kitty Hawk, which was an amazing achievement. But the Wright brothers weren't satisfied. Their plane really, they didn't know how to turn it. They couldn't control it, and they really couldn't keep it aloft for extended periods. So they returned home to Dayton and were determined to get there. But it was a tough, grueling journey to get to the Outer Banks in 1903. And they didn't want to do it again. They wanted to do something closer to home. So they found a field owned by their banker, a man named Torrence Huffman, about 8 miles east of Dayton. They were already familiar with it. And it had some aspects that were really good. It had the interurban trolley that they could go from Dayton out to the station there called Sim Station for only a nickel every day without having to worry about transportation. So they could go out to Huffman Prairie easily. It was a pasture, so they had to chase the cows and the horses out of the field before they could fly. But they set up a small hangar in the back of the pasture and set about trying to get back to where they were at Kitty Hawk, and it took them a while. They didn't have the winds from the sea or the soft sand to crash in, but they did their best and came up with an ingenious catapult system to launch to give the plane a boost to get it up into the air to make up for the lack of the winds from the ocean. Once they did that, they really made great progress. And by the end of 1905, they could circle the field 30 times until the fuel tank ran dry. And they really learned how to turn at that point and maneuver the aircraft and how to be a pilot.
And the key to that was the warped wing.
Yes.
I'm not going to ask you how that worked because the last time I asked somebody that question, it was David McCullough, and we were talking about his biography of the Wright brothers. And I said, so the warped wing, sir, how did that work? And he immediately changed the subject. So I'm not going to ask you to explain that either.
Well, thank you.
My guest is David Nolan. You mentioned their banker, Huffman, of the name Huffman Prairie. His father was the original owner, correct?
Grandfather.
Grandfather. This Huffman, I loved – that's my favorite quote in the book when he talked about the Wright brothers. After being so nice and saying, yeah, you can use this land, just make sure the cows and the horses are out of your way. But to others, he said
– he said, they're fools. Yeah.
I love that. What a great quote. Yeah, yeah, it's remembered that they were out there doing this stuff, and a lot of people thought that they were crazy. They didn't even get any newspaper coverage in the local papers. They were virtually ignored, which was probably a good thing because they could focus on their work.
Could be. Yeah, I suppose so.
All right. So let's move forward into time and to the place where David Nolan gets involved with Huffman Prairie. And you don't just make a prairie come back, do you?
No. The prairie like that we found with my father back in 1984 wasn't exactly like the one that had been there for hundreds or thousands of years, because it had been a pasture for a long time. And all the military had done quite a few things out there that affected it, and it was mowed continuously. And when you do that, it changes the site. It some things can't stand that, and they're not there anymore. And the only things that are left are the ones that can withstand all that impact. So early on, it was sort of resolved to not just protect it the way it is, but try to put it back the way it used to be. Ecological restoration. It was a brand new field at the time that is still pretty new, I think. And as prairies were being restored all over the Midwest, as others learn how to do this. So the last 30-some years has been a learning curve to learn how to restore a prairie. But there's been quite a lot of success. If you go out there, if anybody's out there goes and sees it, it is impressive. I think a lot. It looks a lot like it used to, but I wasn't there. I'll never really know.
Uh-huh. And you talk about just some of the technical aspects of this, like finding a combine. Was it a combine that they found that they could harvest the seeds with?
Yes.
I love the story where this guy's driving this combine, and they're trying to stop him because they think he's going to have an accident.
Yeah. We learned that you could harvest the prairie grass seeds with a wheat combine. You know, it's a pretty big machine that farmers use to combine wheat. So the Metro Parks, or the Park District at the time, acquired one just for this purpose. And we had a farmer that was the manager of the Carriage Hill Farm who knew all about it, and he volunteered to help. And he was kind of a practical fellow, and he drove that combine right through the Mansion District of Oakwood. And then zoom down Springfield Street. If anybody's been there, there's where the train tracks go over Springfield Street. There's those real narrow overpass for the railroad. And the combine, only by just maybe 2 inches, could fit through that thing. But he zoomed through there without even worrying about it. Everybody else was sure it was going to be a major accident. But he got to the prairie safely, and it worked very well. We harvested a lot of prairie grass seeds out there that could be used for the restoration of the prairie, because some of it is, you know, some of it is in great shape and some of it needed some help.
You just mentioned train tracks, and part of this history takes us back to when Huffman Prairie actually had some different kinds of what would you call them, interurbans or trolleys, or what were these things that went through there? One of them was named after Clifton and Yellow Springs, right?
Well, early on, there were all the roads in Ohio were turnpikes. The state didn't give money to build roads at first. So all the roads that we're familiar with now, like Dayton-Yellow Springs Road, that was the same road, the Yellow Springs-Clifton Turnpike.
Oh, okay.
So private companies would finance the construction of the roads, and the investors then would charge a toll for people to use the road, and that would eventually pay for it.
I see. That's so, right. These were all turnpikes, but they left. You have a road going through there, it's going to damage the topography.
Oh, yes. Uh-huh. Yeah. And there were roads that crossed the prairie that did leave some footprints that you can still see even today.
What was the toll to go down the Clifton-Yellow Springs turnpike?
I don't know. That's a good question.
Like a penny?
Yeah, I don't know. I do know that they had, the early ones anyway, had toll toll houses. You could actually stay along the route. Nice stone houses.
Picture that.
Yeah.
My guest is David Nolan. His book is Discovery and Renewal on Huffman Prairie, Where Aviation Took Wing. And as we get to the back of the book, you hit us hard with some amazing photos of all these plants and all this wildlife, all these insects and moths and butterflies and little mammals crawling around. This is really fun. I didn't know a lot of these plants. And is it true that they've actually discovered some wildlife out there that was previously not documented?
Yes, there are three species of moth that were observed out there for the first time and described to science. Now, they're small, and part of that is not very many people are looking at little moths, but still it's pretty impressive in this day and age to discover species new to science.
Uh-huh.
And one of them was named by the scientist who discovered them, Eric Metzler, after the Wright brothers, and one of them was named after Huffman Prairie.
Wow. Well, I'm sure that butterflies love this sort of an environment.
Oh, it's amazing. If you go out there, I was just out there yesterday, and the number of bees and butterflies and insects is kind of beyond belief in a wild prairie. They are a rich thing that we had that was lost and are only now really discovering how beautiful and valuable they are.
And most prairie remnants are very small. They would be maybe along a railroad right away or in a very old cemetery, right?
That's right, because they were about the only scraps of land that weren't converted to farms. And the prairie makes its own soil over hundreds and thousands of years. It's the best soil on the planet, really. And that is the Corn Belt. So there's a strong incentive to convert that land to crops, and only a few accidental places they were left. The one on Huffman is nice because of the Wright brothers, it got turned into an airfield early on, and was spared the modern agriculture that is very efficient.
It's kind of a miracle, isn't it?
Well, yeah. And it had a boost from the 1913 flood, too, because all that land was right after the Wright brothers. It was bought by the Miami Conservancy District, and they acquired it all, and it went into basic public ownership. And then it was eventually transferred, all that land is now we call Patterson Field, to the federal government.
You're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO, and this is our interview with David Nolan, and we're going to come back with our final segment in which we're going to talk about how this became a big air base out there, the history of that, and also a guy named Arthur Morgan. That's coming up right after this. You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world since 1958. And David Nolan hopped on the turnpike and came out to see us. He lives in Washington Township, and he has a new book called Discovery and Renewal on Huffman Prairie, Where Aviation Took Wing. And speaking of taking wings, the Wright brothers are the main reason we even have Huffman Prairie now. Let's look at the history of this being an airfield and how that all happened.
Yes. Well, the 1913 flood is probably the big thing that got things going, because the region formed the Miami Conservancy District to make sure that such a flood never happened again. And that was another Dayton innovation, I think, that the town is famous for. This was an unheard of government's solution to the flooding problem. And the Conservancy District resolved to make five large earthen dams to back up floodwater after a storm to keep it from hitting the major cities along the river. It was pretty ingenious. A fellow named Arthur Morgan came up with the program, and that was the program the Conservancy District adopted. So one of the dams was located, we call Huffman Dam, east of, about 8 miles east of Dayton along the Mad River. It was a good spot to build a dam to back up water because of the geology. But they also had to have the right to flood behind that dam. So there's some 7,000 acres of land behind that dam that would get underwater if the dam backed up. And the Conservancy then had to buy the land to acquire those rights. And they had the power of eminent domain. And it was somewhat controversial. Some wanted, of course, to protect the region from flooding. But if you own the land, it's not comfortable having the government come and take it from you. But that is what happened. And the what they call the retarding basin, or the land behind the dam, was acquired by the Conservancy District.
Isn't this where the village of Osborne used to be located?
Yes, and you know, that village was in that what they call retarding basin, and it had to be moved. So the Conservancy District moved the entire town next to the nearby town of Fairfield. And in 1950, it became – they just combined the two and made it the city of Fairborn.
Uh-huh. And when we think of Fairborn, we think of Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, and that was very important that the federal government wanted to cooperate and go along with this idea to preserve the prairie, isn't it?
Oh, yes. The base has been a great steward of the prairie, and they've been very concerned about it and do their best to protect it and restore it. In fact, I'd give a shout-out to their natural resource managers, Darren Warner and Danielle Trevino. Good job.
All right. The book is Discovery and Renewal on Huffman Prairie, where aviation took wing. And there's so much history in here and all these beautiful photographs. What was the process? When did you get the idea, I'm going to write a book about Huffman Prairie?
You know, I didn't. I retired 3 years ago, and I didn't intend to write a book when I retired, but I just started doing it. And I think maybe I had been writing it in my head for a long time. There was a newspaper reporter named Roz Young,
sure,
who used to write about Huffman Prairie. And one time I sent her a note suggesting, here's some more stories if you want them. And she just sort of wrote back, well, if you think it's such a great story, you should write the book.
She was a legend, Roz Young.
Yeah, and she had some great stories that are in the book.
And she knew everybody back in the day. Yeah, she knew everybody.
So that was probably where I got the idea. I don't know, but it took a couple years to put it all together.
Well, if you would like to meet David, he does have some public events coming up, and he'll be there with his book, and he'll be talking about it. And one of these events that's coming up is going to be right here in Yellow Springs, and he will be here on Sunday, September 30th at the Glen Helen Ecology Institute, 405 Corey Street, between 2 and 5 o'clock. He'll be talking about the book and signing copies of it, I'm sure. He'll also be in Cincinnati, and they have their big book festival, Books by the Banks, on October 20th, and he'll be one of the authors there for that. So if you go down to Books by the Banks, you'll need to track him down there. I'm sure there'll be 100 authors there at least or more. It's a pretty crazy scene, but I hear it's great. Have you ever been?
No, yeah. No, I haven't.
Well, and it's a weird coincidence, but you just mentioned Arthur Morgan, who was responsible for the flood control in Dayton after the 1913 flood. And then he went on to become the president of Antioch College some years later, which is our licensee here at WYSO. And you will be at the Glen Helen Ecology Institute, which is part of Antioch College. So somewhere Arthur Morgan, I guess, would be pleased about all this.
I would hope so. Yeah, I think he would be.
We have a lot of discussion in our community about the impacts of development, about the impacts of losing green space, the impacts of quarries, we have all this limestone around here. Right now, there's some discussion in our community about the impact of a quarry. I understand that you're kind of an expert on this.
Wow. I don't know I'd go that far, but I'll do my best.
What's it do to, say, streams in the area? What's the problem?
Well, I think you're referring to a proposed limestone quarry that's in the area. And the thing is there is a fen nearby that's a groundwater-fed wetland, and like we've been describing. And so it's totally dependent on the flow of the groundwater going through glacial deposits and coming out, you know, so it sort of has its own chemistry and temperature. And if you remove the source of that water, the thing will dry up, and all the things that have lived there for centuries or more than that, for thousands of years, will not be able to survive there anymore. So I think if you go messing around with the hydrology, you know, there can be consequences to the natural communities as well as wells and things like that. Now, when you said that, I won't pretend to be a geologist or an expert on a particular situation. But in general terms, I think you do need to be concerned with these last remaining wetlands that we have.
So can I presume you're not a big fan of fracking?
Well, I don't know. I don't know that I could.
I'm not trying to put you on the spot, Dave.
Well, I mean, any sort of energy has its ups and downs, has its pluses and minuses. Yeah. And if you remove one, you're going to have to do more of one of the other ones. So
yeah, the cause and effect.
Yeah,
it can just take a long time, right?
Yeah.
I thought it was interesting that you talked about this climate change way, way back. Was that millions of years ago?
Thousands
of years ago?
Yes, 6,000 to 8,000 years ago. We had a pretty major climate change in this part of the country.
When we look at the long view of history on the planet, and we look at the very short amount of time that we've been here being human beings, it's pretty amazing. When you look at the long view, you look at the ice ages, you look at this climate change that you mentioned. I never heard about that. I mean, it's just such a long history.
Mm-hmm.
How do we know this stuff? Is it because of ice samples that they look at? I mean, how do they know?
Yes, they look at ice samples to see, you know, how much carbon is in the atmosphere. They look at, bogs and fens, you know, the long cores they take in there that shows what kind of vegetation used to be there. You know, there are some pretty clever ways people can figure out what happened in the past.
What exactly is a fen?
A fen is a wetland that is fed by mineral-rich flowing groundwater. So it's we talked a little bit about the glacial deposits, the gravel and sand deposits that the glaciers left behind. Well, it rains and it falls on these deposits and slowly percolates through them. And oftentimes the spring water will hit something solid like some bedrock somewhere and it'll flow out of the ground. You know, it's just like Yellow Springs. That's what's going on at the Yellow Spring. The water moves until it hits something and it flows out onto the surface. So where you have that happening with a fen, the spring water and the lime in it form this stuff called marl that is just like this limey mud that only some things can survive in.
Uh-huh.
And then over time, those things make peat. So a fen sort of has the marl and the peat and a lot of these plants that have evolved actually in a colder climate.
Well, it sounds like you had your dream job over there.
Yeah, I did. I was lucky.
Uh-huh.
It's a great organization. They have a levy coming up too. I hope people support it.
Who all votes on that particular levy? Is that just for the county?
Yeah, the voters of Montgomery County approve the levy. Now, a park district like that has jurisdiction, can have property in adjacent counties, and the Five Rivers Metro Parks does, has facilities in Green, Warren counties.
Uh-huh. So, Well, you had maps. You have so many maps, informative ones in your book, and I was fascinated by the one that shows where the fens and these other glacial deposits were. And I was trying to look at the county line there. Right now we're here just at the top of Greene County going into Clark County, and I was looking there and I was going, now how close are these things to where I am right now? Are any of those close by to here that you know of?
Yeah, the surveyor's records show a large prairie like Huffman right going into Yellow Springs.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
On what side? Is that the Clark County side or?
Be the west side.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. And it's all gone.
It's all gone. Well, no, I mean, there have been some restorations going on in the area that are pretty nice.
Uh-huh.
I know there's some in Glen Helen. I think the Glass Farm, there's some things planted out there. And people are, I think, getting a lot more in tune with this stuff. And you're seeing more and more restoration, whether it's to bring back a prairie or habitat for pollinators.
Mm.
There's some good stuff going on.
You're fascinated by all this, aren't you?
Sure.
Yeah. Well, I had a guy on who I think lived in one of these areas where they must have had a lot of this glacial deposit, and it was up in Upper Sandusky. And this guy was a farmer and a really smart guy, and his name was Gene Logsdon. He died about 2 years ago, but Gene knew about all this kind of stuff, and I had a conversation with him one time about pollinators, and he said, yeah, everybody's worried about these honeybees. He says, you know, honeybees aren't even native to North America. He says, we've got all these other little pollinators out there, and they've been here all along.
Oh, yeah. It's an amazing diversity. If you actually take the time to go out to a prairie and just look at how many types of insects and beetles and wasps, you know, all sorts of things that have always been there. And it is pretty wondrous.
Well, you have some great photos of bugs in this book. And I actually learned, I said, oh, that's that kind of butterfly. I didn't know. And so many moths. We see these beautiful moths, these big, colorful things. I don't even know what they are. I see them and I go, what is that thing? They almost look like they're alien.
Yeah, yeah. There are some weird-looking moths out there. You know, people are really getting into that now. In fact, they have a whole conference called Mothapalooza.
No.
Yeah, I'm serious. I think it's going to be coming up next year. They do it. They're doing it every other year now. But it's down at the Shawnee State Forest Lodge, and it fills up within hours of the conference being announced.
I take it you go.
I've actually never been to Mothapalooza. I never get to register in time.
Really?
Because you got to do it like the day it opens. But they have all these experts down there. They put up all these lights at night and sheets, and they tracked all these weird moths, really almost mind-boggling. And it's very popular.
Amazing. What's the response been to the book?
Well, pretty good. I mean, it's not overwhelming. I guess I'm not very good at marketing, but
you have a marketing expert in the family, right?
Well, I have my wife who knew of the Vic McCunis's radio show,
and here you are,
and here I am. So I'm glad I have.
She
that.
Emailed me. She said, "Do you know about Dave's book?" and I heard from Kent State Press the other day. They sent me an email.
Is that right?
Yeah. So. There's people out there. We're out there. We're working on it. We're getting the word out.
Well, I think it's an interesting story. I think Huffman Prairie is an important part of Dayton's history that is good to be aware of.
And this is the only book that you're ever going to write, huh, Dave?
Well, as far as I know,
okay.
We'll see.
So this is it. This is the labor of love.
Yeah, I don't. I imagine.
It's your life's work, right?
Well, it's been something that's very important to me.
Yeah.
I've got other things that are too. But,
yeah. Like what?
Well, my family, of course.
Sure.
I think my career at Five Rivers is important to me.
Uh-huh.
I'm involved with a really impressive nonprofit called the Beaver Creek Wetlands Association. And so there's plenty of things out there to keep one occupied.
And what does the Beaver Creek Wetlands Association do?
Oh, well, one of the best system of remaining wetlands that we've been talking about, fens, is is a large valley west of Yellow Springs along the valley of the Beaver and Little Beaver Creeks. And there's some – this land trust has helped protect over 2,000 acres of some of the best remaining wetlands systems in this region.
Nice.
And, so if you go over there to Siebenthaler Fen or Fairborn Marsh or Kugler Wetlands or Creekside Reserve, there's a lot of places you can go now and learn about these rich wetlands we have.
What is the difference between a fen and a bog?
A fen has the flowing groundwater going through the glacial deposits. A bog is generally an old lake that is filling in. You know, the glaciers oftentimes would leave these. Oftentimes, it'd be a big block of ice that would melt, and then or that would get covered up, and then it would melt, leaving like a hole. And over time, that fills up. It doesn't have flowing water in it, and it becomes acidic. So acid bogs, you know, they have the sphagnum and the pitcher plants and things like that, but they don't have flowing water like a fen does.
So, say Cedar Bog up by Champaign County, up in there, is that that's an old lake then?
It's a fen. Cedar Bog is not a bog.
Okay, but so it's a misnomer.
It's a misnomer.
Okay, I wondered about that.
Yeah,
because it seems like a fen.
It is. Yeah,
in my mind,
it's a doozy of a fen. It's sort of the queen of the fens.
Yeah, it's a pretty amazing fen,
yeah,
isn't it?
It really is.
Okay. So why'd they call it a bog, I wonder?
Well, back in those days, people didn't really differentiate. You know, a bog is just a mucky ground, I guess, and so they called it a bog. But technically, it's a fen.
And what kind of strange creatures live down there that we never see?
Well, there's certainly a lot of strange vegetation that has been there since the glaciers left. But there are creatures that pretty much only live in fens, like the Massasauga rattlesnake, the spotted turtle. Those are only two that are popping into my mind this very second. But
and they used to find those Massasaugas out in Huffman, but they haven't seen them in a long time, have they?
Since the 1990s, they've tried to find them and haven't.
They found four in what, 1994, and they haven't seen them since?
Right. That doesn't mean they're not there, but it could be they're not there. Yeah. Nobody really knows.
Well, you've got some great photos in here. You've got a photo of the guy with the rattlesnake in 1994. And one of my favorites is you actually, when you went out and you had that origin story at the beginning of the interview where you're with your dad and you go out and you see the guy on the mower out on Huffman Prairie, you actually have a photo of the guy.
Yeah.
It's like it's all here.
Yeah. Yeah, that guy who was the boss, he was just kind of looking there like, oh, what the hell, you know. But the base has been great, really, and the whole time. They've been a good steward.
Well, it's been a pleasure having you on the program.
It's been a pleasure to be here.
My guest has been Dave Nolan. His book is Discovery and Renewal on Huffman Prairie, where aviation took wing, and you can meet him. He will be out here in Yellow Springs for an event at the Glen Helen Ecology Institute. Put this on your calendars, Sunday, September 30th, from 2 o'clock until 5 o'clock. And he'll also be at Books by the Banks in Cincinnati on October 20th. You'll just have to try to find him because there'll be all kinds of writers and books and everything out there, and he'll probably be sitting there at his little table going, come over here. Oh, wow. Well, this is a beautiful book, and I highly recommend it. You've been listening to The Book Nook on WYSO for The Book Nook. I'm Vic McCunis. Thanks for tuning in.